Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us from Washington, working on 2 hours of sleep, which is close to what we're all working on here, CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett. So not quite the wave. What surprised you? Anything?
Sure. That in a state like Florida, where the polling had suggested Andrew Gillum, the Democratic nominee for governor, and Bill Nelson, the incumbent Democratic senator, were leading, both of them saw their leads vanish as the night wore on, and Andrew Gillum has conceded, and Rick Scott has declared himself the winner in that seat. So that was two races where the polling data, for sure, looked as if it was heading in one direction, the result in another. And I think that is symptomatic of something in places where President Trump campaigned and campaigned aggressively, like Missouri, Indiana, North Dakota, possibly also Montana, that the Trump voter is harder to measure than any other kind of voter that we have seen. They don't participate in polls, meaning when they're called at home or on their cell phone. They don't participate in exit polls. They don't share their opinions widely. And when election day comes, they sort of rise to the surface and give races that appear to be working against the Republican an edge, and races where Republicans were already ahead, a bigger margin of victory. We certainly saw that in Indiana and Missouri Senate races, to name just two.
That's fascinating. So, number one, the Trump mojo is still there. But number two, Trump voters, their distrust of the media extends also to pollsters, huh?
Pollsters, which they more or less conflate as part of the same complex that they distrust or mistrust or have even more hostile feelings toward. And this is particularly true in rural parts of America, like the panhandle of Florida came in very strong for both Rick Scott, the Republican, and Ron DeSantis, the Trump-endorsed Republican nominee for governor. That was certainly true in Missouri. It may very well prove to be decisive and true in Montana, North Dakota, Indiana, Tennessee, for sure. Races that appear close, based on the polling, in some cases break more solidly. We are now seeing a sorting in American politics in the Trump era between rural and white and urban, suburban, and diverse. And that may be more important in terms of identity politics than ideological politics. Hard to know yet, but that's certainly something worth watching.
Do we know anything about the millennials? Did they show up?
They did. And what's interesting is, in this midterm election, if from a 30,000-foot perspective you say it's better for people to vote, then at that level you have to be elated with this midterm election. 113 million votes at least, far exceeding turnouts in 2010, 2014, and possibly one of the highest participation levels in a midterm election we've seen in decades. So at the participatory level, that's good news. If you believe that a thriving democracy is one in which more people participate than did the last time, the last midterm election. So millennials did turn out, but guess what? So did a lot of Trump voters, and so did a lot of Republicans and independents. Lots of people turned out. Democrats did drive up their midterm turnout substantially, but so did Republicans. And I guarantee you, when the president has his press conference here at the East Room, he's going to say the Trump effect is real. When I go out and personalize election, my people show up. And that's what happened. You had heavy turnout enthusiasm on both sides.
Well, whatever it takes. I agree with them that the more votes, the better, whatever the turnout. Now, as to what the Democrats decide to do with their House majority, are they still talking about impeachment? Are they still talking about resistance? Or is there a chance they will cooperate to do things that people agree on, such as fixing up highways and saving pre-existing conditions?
Right. So big questions all. Investigations, absolutely. The incoming Democrat leading the Oversight Committee on the House, Elijah Cummings, has already put out a press release. I'm going to investigate the president on a lot of different levels and his administration. The Democrat who will be in charge of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means, which is the Tax Writing Committee in the House, has already said in a press release this morning he wants to see the president's taxes and tax returns. So investigations will be part of it. Will impeachment? Probably not, at least not initially, and certainly not before Robert Mueller either finishes his investigation and provides a report to Congress and or both. On legislation, yes, in theory there are areas of compromise, but think about this. The House Republican seats or incumbents who lost were those most inclined toward collaboration and compromise. They're gone. So the House Republican minority is now more Trumpian, more conservative, more hardline. the incoming House Democratic majority is, by historical standards, going to be relatively small. That's going to put a very high premium on party unity. And Democrats would be the first to tell you they have not resolved this internal conflict between progressivism and centrism. And that's going to have to be decided, or at least adjudicated among Democrats, before they can decide what their legislative agenda is. Because to pursue that legislative agenda in a narrowly drawn House with a small majority, you've all got to stick together. So I think one of the first things that House Democrats are going to have to do is decide what they want to prioritize, what they can all vote for, because you can be pretty confident most of the remaining House Republicans aligned with Trump are not going to go for it.
CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett, sounding remarkably coherent for 2 hours of sleep. Your stamina is legendary. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Everybody stand. Take off your hats, please. This is the state's anthem. Kind of a grunge reimagining of it, but it is the state's anthem.
It is rousing.
And that signals another feature from our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System. The very first time Washington voters took part in a midterm election was way back in November of 1890.
Yeah, and they were all male voters, of course, because women wouldn't get to vote here.
Oh, we voted by mail then, too? How about that?
That's a good one, Dave. I like that.
Thank you.
And look how tired you are. So it was the middle of President Benjamin Harrison's one and only term in the White House. A little background, of course. Washington Territory became the state of Washington in November 1889. It's our 129th birthday this coming Sunday. As far as the U.S. Congress is concerned, during that territorial era from 1853 to 1889, we had a representative in Congress. He was chosen by a statewide vote of men, but he didn't get to vote, and nobody in Washington Territory got to vote in any of the presidential elections from the 1850s to the 1880s. So then in the statehood era, we were apportioned a single member of the House of Representatives who did vote, and we also got to vote for the president in 1892. Anyway, and in those years, our senators were elected by the legislature. They weren't elected directly. We wouldn't get that till the 1914. So the first race for Congress in Washington was in October of 1889. Republican John Lockwood Wilson, a 40-something Indiana-born lawyer from Spokane Falls, he won. He beat a guy from Tacoma named Thomas Griffiths by about 34,000 to 24,000 votes. In his commercials, Wilson talked about how during college he polished the floors of Yesler's Mill. No, I'm just kidding. That's a Dino Rossi joke. Stepping back a bit, Republicans had held power in Washington pretty much since the Civil War. The former Whigs and anti-slavery Democrats melded it into a post-Civil War Republican coalition that lasted here for decades. So in the midterms of 1890, Wilson had been in office for just an hour, just a year, and the president was Benjamin Harrison, right? He beat Grover Cleveland in 1888. The big national issue in 1890 was, guess what? The McKinley Tariff.
Wow.
The future president McKinley had passed a bill as the House Ways and Means Committee chairman that raised tariffs on everything. Before the tariffs even kicked in, the public went nuts. Prices were raised by merchants. So you can probably guess the midterms of 1890 were a disaster for the Republicans, and across the U.S. it was a Democratic landslide. In the final tally, Republicans lost 93 seats.
Yikes.
Democrats gained 86. This is when there was only 331 seats in the House.
That's a rout.
But here in Washington, how do you guess Republican John L. Wilson fared? Did the anti-McKinley blue wave wash over the Evergreen State? It actually didn't, because his challenger was a Democrat named Thomas Carroll, who knew it was a lost cause. The Post-Intelligencer called Thomas Carroll a respectable man of moderate abilities.
That's a ringing endorsement.
And I think they were a pro-Democrat paper, which is kind of bizarre. Yeah. Anyway, and they characterized his willingness to accept the Democratic nomination as something of a lost cause. Essentially, nobody else wanted the job, and it was, quote, fully realized there was not the ghost of a show for success.
Aww.
So in spite of the blue wave, John L. Wilson did beat back his Democratic challenger by a smaller margin than he'd done the year before. And Wilson kind of, I'm surprised there's not more memories of Wilson as a Republican leader in Washington. I'm surprised there's not things named after him. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is. But
our quarterback is named after him. Sorry.
Well, late night, huh?
Yeah, really late night.
So Wilson went on to serve 3 terms in the House, was elected to the U.S. Senate, later became publisher of the PI. It was front page news when he died in 1912. As a senator, he's credited with getting the assay office here during the gold rush, which helped us lure a lot of miners here and shake them down of all their funds to get them to go before they went north. He also got pork for the shipyard in Bremerton and for Mount Rainier National Park. So he's a big guy, but nobody really remembers him anymore. In the next election in 1892, the Democrats lost several seats in the House, but Democrat Grover Cleveland came back and beat Benjamin Harrison. So this is when Cleveland, he was president for 4 years, then he lost, and he came back and won second non-consecutive term.
Well, we helped him do that, huh?
Yeah. And then came the Panic of 1893, and all hell broke loose. By 1894, that McKinley tariff had been replaced with the first income tax, because before, the government in those days made their money off tariffs. There was no income tax. So the McKinley tariff meant huge amounts of income for the government. And so we added a second member to the House from Washington in 1892, and we've gradually added to the point where we have nine now. And there's one more noteworthy thing on the ballot in 1890. That was to vote for the state capitol. Olympia won, beating North Yakima and Ellensburg soundly.
Wow. So are you saying it went by kind of fast there, Felix? Did we vote for the income tax?
No, the House passed a tariff in 1890. Right. It was very unpopular. Then in 1894, the Democrats lessened the tariff and put an income tax instead place instead. Yes. That was the first income tax in 1894.
So do we know whether anybody, any Washington representatives voted for the income tax?
I don't have that. That's a great question.
Because that would be the last time a Washingtonian ever voted for an income tax.
Now that would be news.
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Felix. Felix Bunnell is brought to us by the King County Library System. All his features are on MyNorthwest.com. The balance of power in Olympia was also on the line in the midterms. Democrats were looking to grow their ultra-thin majorities in the House and the Senate. Republicans warned of dire consequences. They didn't win back some of those seats to bring balance back to the legislature. And Hannah Scott is now with how things turned out on the state level, which I have not heard very much about. So lay it out for us here.
So I've got a lot of numbers for you. I didn't talk to many state candidates last night. But what I can tell you is this is many of the races that you and I have talked about in the weeks leading up to this midterm really came into play in what we saw last night. So there were very limited options for Republican legislative candidates to take any seats from the Democrats in the legislature. So for the Republicans, this was all about holding on to what they had. Democrats were looking to snatch anywhere from 8 to 24 seats between the House and Senate going into last night. After the initial results, things were looking good for Democrats. State Democratic Senator David Frocht, who appears to have easily been reelected in the 46th with 83% of the vote, says they look like they're going to make some gains in the Senate after last night.
The Senate, we are up one and we're functionally tied in two. So we think we've got a real good chance to pick up three. We'll see as the votes come in. Obviously, you don't know for sure on election night in Washington State. But we run a really good campaign and we feel really positive.
Among the Republican seats in the Senate that could flip is Mark Malosha. That's down in the 31st in Federal Way. That's where Democrat Claire Wilson has a 6-point lead right now in this race. And it's one of the major targets for Democrats. Mm-hmm. They've really been focused on
this. He was a former Democrat, right?
Yeah, he was, and he flipped. Claire Wilson, I talked to her before the primary. I talked to both of them. He felt like he represented his district and he'd have the support, but she felt like it was time for change. So she's got that big, it's a significant lead at this point. Several Republican-held seats are also super close. Republican and Trump ally Doug Erickson is leading his Democratic challenger by just under a point in the 42nd. That's up in Whatcom County. He's had that seat for quite some time. It's a longtime Republican seat, I believe. And it's the same deal over in the 26th Gig Harbor area, where Republican Jan Angel's decision not to run left this seat open, been Republican for at least 5 years. It's the most expensive state legislative race there was this election cycle. It's got Democrat Emily Randall taking on Republican Marty McClendon. Randall right now leading by just a point. Republican Senator Joe Fain in the 47th at South King County, also at risk. Of course, he's got the rape allegation that wasn't investigated that came out against him after the primary. They didn't really make it a huge campaign issue. He's up against Democratic challenger Mona Doss, who we talked to on the show. Right now, they're two, just separated by a point, with Fain leading just barely. And in the House, it looks like Democrats are taking over the 5th District, Issaquah Snoqualmie, where Democrats already hold the Senate seat, but the House seats have been Republican for a long time. Mm-hmm. Right now, both of the House seats, the Democratic challengers are leading by 5 points, the both of them. So it looks like that whole district could go blue. That is Lisa Callan and Bill Ramos, the Democrats who are leading there. In Snohomish County, the 44th District, John Lovick, who had a lot of support, but he too, there was some controversy after the primary. We talked to him on that show, in the show about that. He's out 57% ahead of his Republican challenger, Jeff Sachs. Yeah, so very solid. You know, he's well known. He's again, wasn't a big issue in the campaign. One of the interesting parts here is Mark Harmsworth, Republican, the other one in the Republican in the other 44th House seat. Jared Mead is his challenger. Jared Mead, the Democrat, the youngest, the 27-year-old. He is out ahead by 5 points.
Well, Harmsworth was the anti-toll guy.
Yeah, this was the race that really focused on the tolls, right? And Mark Harmsworth is promising always to fight against the tolls. Right. And
That's surprising. Is that a statement that Snohomish County likes tolls?
No, I wouldn't say so. And Jared Mead really didn't say he wouldn't toll. So the whole big controversy in that race was that Jared Mead said that there's no actual plan to toll the trestle. And Mark Rumsfeld says there absolutely is, and there is. But he's overplaying it kind of became a big deal. But then Meade never ever said that he would support tolls, at least not on the existing lanes there. So unclear. But he's young, and they, again, I think I told you before, I've had some people describe him as a Kennedy to me, wow. A lot of promise. So we'll see how that goes. Jared Meade up about 5 points in that race right now. Some interesting points that we are seeing is Republican State Representative Matt Shea, who, of course, just had recent controversy of his own with his white nationalism notes and things that were found.
The biblical argument for war.
Yes, that's it. He won re-election. He got nearly 60% of the vote over in the Spokane County area, as did Republican Matt Manweller, who was also hit with multiple sexual misconduct allegations. He won his re-election in the 13th district, but everybody already knew that he was going to resign as soon as he won. So there you go. So right now, just to be clear, we know about 3 House seats that are likely going Democrat that were Republican, and at least one that is going in the Senate to the Democrats, but they're expecting maybe to get several more.
Again, a ripple, not a wave.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we'll have to see how there's a lot of still really tight races, but I would say somewhere in between a ripple and a wave. What I do know is that this is both, just 1 in 3 seats still grows their majority in both chambers. And we're going to see things from the Democrats I've talked to. We're going to see carbon tax because it failed on the ballot. It's definitely coming to the legislature. Capital gains tax, absolutely coming to the legislature, and some other issues. So,
right. Okay. Maybe an Eddie. Anyway, thank you, Hannah.
You're welcome.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from that avalanche of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle. So, Bruce Irvin's
not coming here.
Not coming here.
I'm bummed.
Too bad.
Probably going to help my pocketbook.
What happened?
Well, I don't know. I feel like you ever have someone that's playing footsie with you, giving you goo-goo eyes?
Is that what he was doing?
Yes. Yes, he was. He was liking
that's
some of the Twitter posts. He said, Big Macs, huh, Danny? On Twitter,
Aww.
He was telling people he was going to come, and now he's going to go stay. He's going to go to Atlanta. Yeah, it is. From the perspective, here's where it makes sense for him. That's where he grew up. So he's going home, in a sense, to play for a team that probably has a clearer path to snaps. Where he fits on that team is probably a little bit clearer than what he'd be doing here, where they'd have him among a group of pass rushers. And I don't know if it came down to how many snaps can you promise me, how many snaps am I going to get, or whether it was strictly a geographical thing, and he's got some familiarity with Dan Quinn. But I'm bummed, and I think he would have helped the Seahawks. This doesn't spoil the season. This isn't some sort of, oh my gosh, now their chances of making the playoffs just took a huge hit. He would have helped.
Who are they shopping for now, then?
Well, they're probably not too much. You're going to have guys shuffling at the bottom of the roster, but there's not a guy. The answer to this team's hopes to make the playoffs is on the roster. It's not someone they're going to pick up. They've got to make the most of what they got.
What's the word from Coach Carroll? I know he does almost daily press conferences. Is he his usual optimistic self,
yeah,
or is there a different tone?
No, there's definitely. He's always going to be optimistic. He's bummed that they've had three losses, really 4 losses of games that they were in and could have pulled out, and they haven't managed to win any of those. They've won 1 game close late and lost 3 that they had a real chance to.
But he's not indicating anywhere he might be looking to fix or repair, anything like that?
He will talk about it and a need to get better all over and to be more consistent.
Okay.
But no, you don't get a diagnostic report from a coach like you would a mechanic of.
What's your diagnostic report then?
That Russell Wilson, when they struggle to run the ball, Russell tends to have his effectiveness wane, and that's a really problematic trend. Because when you don't run the ball is when you need your quarterback to compensate for it most. Maybe
what can he do, though? Because they know he's going to either run it himself or pass.
Well, he can get better. He can make better decisions and learn from the mistakes he's made so far and feel more comfortable in the offense. This is kind of the challenge over the course of a football season, is that you can't – the team you put out there is not static. You can get better over the course of the season. And in fact, in Pete Carroll's, I would say his first 5 years, we saw his teams get better over the course of the season. And this is a young team, and maybe that'll happen again. And part of this is going to be a young defense getting better. And part of it's going to be the quarterback with a new offensive coordinator and in some ways a new role and a new group of guys catching passes from him, that they're going to get better as well, that the offense is. So you hope for improvement.
Hall of Fame update. Lou Piniella?
Lou Piniella is going to be on the ballot. I don't see him making it. We'll see.
Why not?
He pulls at the heartstrings. He's got one World Series. For all the games he managed, he managed one World Series champion. And he's got a ton of victories, but I don't know how that resume is going to stack up. He's undoubtedly one of the best managers slash coaches.
Well, hasn't he thrown the most bases?
Yeah, he's probably got a Lloyd McClendon might give him a push in that regard, though. He definitely has some epic fits.
Because, I mean, some of those, I've been to the Hall of Fame only once, but it was basically a bunch of old baseballs that people threw once upon a time. Lou could have a bunch of bases that he threw once upon a time.
Yeah. You'd be able to do that. It would certainly give you some different fixtures that are there.
Exactly.
The thing is, I think Edgar's going to get in this year.
Really?
I was just going to ask you that because he passed the, 75% threshold this last time around?
I think he's going to get in this year. There's really been, over the past 3 years, there's been a real sea change in the way voters view him and his career and his effectiveness. Some of it is the rise of baseball analytics and that we measure players differently. It used to be there were threshold numbers, 3,000 hits, 400, certainly 500 home runs.
And never a designated hitter.
And has there ever been a designated?
I thought that was his big hang-up.
That's one of them.
And do you think Big Poppy from Boston, the fact that he was a DH for so long towards the end, and he's going to get in, might help Edgar on the back end of that?
Yes. Edgar certainly played the most games at designated hitter, but there have been guys who've been designated hitters for large chunks that have gotten in before. But there's just been a change in the way he was viewed. He doesn't have 3,000 hits, but he was one of the most effective hitters of his generation, and we kind of see that better in hindsight because of some of the numbers we now use to measure hitters that really weren't as popular 20 years ago.
I see the Mariners are going to get a new pitching coach.
Yeah, we're going to get him. Bring him in here.
I know something about that.
DeLuna? What do you got to tell him?
Technically, well, I was your coach.
I know. What I'm saying is, you got to hold your arm up like this. You're watching on the video, and you got to go like this. See what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's like a
it's
sideways.
The snap. It's the snap.
It's the sideways parade wave, sort of. And then you let a ball go somewhere. And you let the ball go at the right point.
When should they throw their cut fastball?
The cut fastball? That's
the two-seamer.
The two-seamer? That's when the three-seamer isn't working.
Man, there's no three-seamer. You got a four-seamer. Three-seamer might be a non-regulation baseball that we got here.
That's the way they used to pitch. The three-seamer is going to be a thing.
This interview is going poorly, Dave.
Is it really?
This interview is going poorly.
He learned nothing from me.
Well, that's why they got Paul Davis, the new pitching coach.
They're going to have three different guys that kind of handle this. He is one of them. He replaces Mel Stottlemyre. I think it's interesting what they're trying to do. They've hired a guy that's there, Brian DeLuna, who is works in biomechanics.
Wow.
And it's a different background. He's not your traditional, worked his way up the minor leagues, was a former major league pitcher type of guy. They're certainly trying some different things to try and avoid.
You
want to
get your biomechanics right. You want to use your tibia.
I don't know if you use your tibia. You got to worry about your flexor bundle, though.
The flexor bundle. That's it. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, you got to be very worried about your flexor bundle.
That was my point.
And your bursa sac.
And the bursa sac.
You don't want a bursa
Sports
sac.
Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Four statewide initiatives, a huge levy for education, several smaller levies for first responder radios and fire districts. Hannah Scott gets to go into the weeds and tell us how all those turned out.
Hello, okay. Hannah. Good morning, Dave.
I can't wait for this.
Okay. On the statewide initiatives, it is a mixed bag. Three of them passing, one failed. In a major victory for gun control advocates, 60% of Washington voters approved I-1639, which will make the state's gun laws among the top five strictest in the country. This one raises the age to buy semi-automatic rifles to 21, adds more background checks, including annual background checks after you buy any gun. It also has a safe storage requirement, firearm safety training requirement, and the 10-day waiting period. I-1639 campaign manager Stephen Pagliolini says it's a huge and hard-fought victory that is long overdue.
This was a resounding statement to elected officials. If you won't act to keep our schools, our communities safe from gun violence, we'll do it ourselves. My generation will do it ourselves. And at some point, we might do it without you. So I do hope this inspires action in the legislature to work on additional pieces of legislation.
Now, the NRA and other gun rights groups have said they will sue over this, both in possibly state and federal court. He says they're ready for that and feel like they're confident they can win. As for whether we could see even more gun control measures now that this one has passed in the state?
There are additional policies. I could think folks in Washington state would support. The other states have seen have a really measurable impact on reducing gun violence. I won't speak about those particular elements today, but I would definitely look forward to watching closely some of the coalition partners behind this initiative, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, Moms Demand Action, Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. Many of these organizations will have agendas moving forward that I think all of us should support.
Is the NRA really going to challenge this? Because if they lose, that would set potentially a nationwide precedent and green light other similar strict laws like this.
Before passage, I haven't talked to them this morning. I know that that was the plan, as it was with the Second Amendment Foundation here in Bellevue. Huh. So we'll see. I-1634, let's go back. That's the anti-grocery tax that is basically meant to keep other cities from enacting a soda tax like Seattle's. It passed 55-45. And it's stripping the local control there so that there will be no soda tax in other cities or counties, and Seattle's is not allowed to go any higher. On I-1631, the carbon fee, this was a bit of a surprise to some people. Yeah. This is big on the governor's wish list, and it did not pass. The carbon fee, which would have taxed greenhouse gas emissions from both utilities and vehicles by charging $15 per metric ton of carbon emissions starting in 2 years and increase every $2 every year after, it is failing. It was 56% in the no column compared to 43% in the yes column. Opponents say it just wasn't right.
We ran a fact-based campaign to make sure that voters had the information they needed. They found that it would have burdened our economy, families, and small businesses with a costly, unfair, and ineffective energy tax that would increase costs for Washington families by hundreds of dollars a year.
Now, this only passed in King and Jefferson County. There were also oversight concerns because of the board.
Right.
But don't expect that to be the end of this, because this is very, very likely to come up in the state legislature.
It's one of those things where King County could not call the tune this time.
No. Yeah, it didn't matter. Almost the entire rest of the state said no. I-940, the Police Accountability Initiative, also passing with 62% of the vote. And while some in law enforcement are against this, King County Sheriff Mitzi Johanknet came out as a supporter. And Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, a former federal prosecutor, is also glad that it passed.
I-942, I think it just shows you, when you look at the margin, it shows you that people are very thoughtful and they know the job of policing is a tough job. But we've got to be able to give police the tools they need, good training and de-escalation, and hold them accountable when they're wrong. And we've seen in the city of Seattle, this kind of training works and saves lives.
She's also very glad that her Seattle education levy, Prop 1, passed with that overwhelmed like 69% of the vote.
It's huge.
This is the biggest education tax ever asked for in the city at more than $600 million over 7 years, but it passed. It'll help pay for expanding subsidized pre-K care, early learning, K through 12, extra counselors, after school programs, and free college for every high school graduate in the city. Wow. Very quickly, a couple of smaller ones, levies in Snohomish County. We have one that is being supported. It would get new radios for police, fire, and EMS agencies. Another school bond, though, in Arlington is failing for the second time in a row. And in the Pierce County area, there's Fire District 17. The EMS and fire are both looking for some levy renewals or lifting of the levy lids. One is passing, one is not. The fire one is passing, the EMS is not. So.
And the other failing levy, the Mercer Island levy, also failed. That was to fund police and fire and senior citizen centers. And that's going to be a crisis.
Yes, it is.
That's going to be a crisis.
All right, team effort. I think we got them all.
Okay, good for you. Thanks, Anna.
You bet.
Joining us in the studio, the apparent winner of the 8th District Congressional Race, Dr. Kim Trier. Congratulations, first of all. You are the last person standing. You started running how long ago?
Almost a year and a half.
So how does it feel?
It feels really good to be at the end of a marathon. It feels really good to have this kind of lead, and the ballots are still being counted, and I believe we need to have those ballots counted. That's the first part of listening to the people in the 8th District. But I think that we've heard a loud message.
And what is the message?
I think the loud message is that people are tired of a Congress run by career politicians who aren't working for the people in this district. And they are so ready for a fresh voice and a pediatrician who's ready to go to bat for them, just like I've gone to bat for my patients.
And Dave and I were just sort of surmising what House Democrats were going to do with this newfound control of the House. I know health care is a big topic for you. What's on the agenda? What sort of checks will you do on the president for power?
Well, I think number one on my agenda is to work on making sure that every family in this country, and certainly in my district, can afford the health care they need, that we take on Big Pharma and bring down prescription drug prices, that we have the voice of a woman doctor in Congress, the only woman doctor in Congress, to stand up for women's reproductive rights. And my goodness, we need to take on campaign finance reform.
So the president is inclined to cut prescription drug prices. At least he said so. The president is inclined to protect pre-existing conditions. At least he has said so. Would you be willing to cooperate with him on those two aspects of the healthcare debate?
Of course, I will sit down at the table with anyone who is really, truly committed to working to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. Problem right now is that a lot of people are in the pockets of Big Pharma, and I am taking no corporate PAC money. I've taken no corporate PAC money, so I will be a real advocate for the people in this district. In terms of pre-existing conditions, look, we're hearing a lot of rhetoric from people who have consistently, I believe 65 times, tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And so I would say let's watch what they do and not just listen to what they say.
You're not taking any PAC money. Does that mean when you leave here, you have to get back on the phone and start fundraising for 2 years from now?
Oh, boy. I haven't thought about that. What I have thought about is that I want to do the absolute best job for the people in this district. And that ultimately is what I hope will lead to a re-election.
And this is a reliably red district. It's been held by a Republican. You'd be the first Democrat. When you were out campaigning and knocking on the doors of Republican voters, what were they telling you?
Well, you know, I could tell that a lot were not going to vote for me, but I still created a lot of goodwill by saying, look, whether you voted for me or not, this is a 50-50 district and it's a toss-up race. At the time, I really thought we were neck and neck and that we might not know the results for weeks. And I asked what was their priority and what they most wanted. And you know what I heard a lot of? Honesty, transparency, getting money out of politics and addressing healthcare. And so I think we all share a lot of the same concerns, and that's why I think I can be a successful congresswoman.
Did you actually find Republicans who are willing to engage in a conversation like that?
Absolutely.
You did.
You know, well, when you meet people at their doors, or you meet people while they're mowing their lawns or working in their garages, I think they're pretty honored that you come and talk and not just pandering for a vote. You're coming to talk.
I couldn't, though. I mean, when I was running in that district, that's one of the things I said. I'm going to engage Republicans. But the moment they saw the D by the name, it was, okay, right, we know who you are. Bye-bye.
You know, I think that may be the difference that a pediatrician makes.
That must be it.
I'm pretty approachable.
Did you wear the white smock when you doorbelled?
No white smock. But just yesterday, I had a gentleman who clearly was not voting for me. And after our brief conversation, he came over in his truck and he said, you know, I just want to stop and thank you for coming by. And we might not agree on any policy issue, but I think we can all get along.
Good, I love that conversation.
Right. Something that came to my attention last night as the tallies were coming in and there was some fervor about, you know, that you could take and turn a reliably red district blue was the fact that there were some ads circulating that seemed anti-Semitic. How did you respond to those ads?
You know, that story came out yesterday. I really was so focused on the election. I didn't respond. I'll tell you, I wasn't surprised. And I can tell you that we all want more civility and respect and inclusivity. And I will work on that.
How will you bring civility when the voices of the angry and the dejected are so loud right now, especially on social media?
Those voices are very loud, but I think that most people in this country do not agree with that. And that if we have a Congress that's willing to stand up to a president with this kind of rhetoric, then we can set a better model. I also think that a lot of women are running, and we want that civility for our children and children all over this country. And so we will set that tone.
You say a Congress that stands up to the president. Impeachment, is that on the table?
Let's work on checks and balances and make sure that we have oversight and not just overlooking. I want Congress to do its job.
Okay, but what does that mean? Because that's going to be the left wing of your party is going to push you to start an impeachment investigation, and you'll be recruited. I wouldn't be surprised if you've gotten some calls already from people in the party asking where you might stand on that. What are you going to tell them?
You know, people can ask all they want. This is a moderate district, and I think what we need is for Congress to do its job of oversight. Frankly, I don't think it matters if you're a Democrat or a Republican, if we have a foreign country meddling in our elections, if we have potential conflict of interest, if we have corruption. It should be investigated.
So have you gotten a call from Nancy Pelosi?
No, but I have to tell you, I have not checked my messages.
Yeah, I would think you'd be getting one. And does she have a serious challenger for speaker?
I don't know who's running yet.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing. According to the ads, you're going to impose a state income tax. And I just wanted to check to see if that's part of your agenda. I don't think, as a member of Congress, you have the power to impose a state income tax, but I just thought I would check anyway.
Thank you for checking. That is a keen observation. I am running for federal office. I have absolutely nothing to do with a state income tax.
I see. So anyway, so the person who came up with that ad just made a careless mistake in doing the research on how the income tax might work in this state. Is that probably
do you really think that was a mistake?
Well, you know, when you're rushing to put together an attack ad, you know, it can be overlooked. Just checking.
When do you
I'm smiling over here.
When do you expect a concession from Dino Rossi, if at all?
Well, let's let those ballots come in. If the margin stays this wide, if we continue to do well in King County, and if we keep our margins in Pierce and Kittitas and Chelan, then I'll leave that up to him. But I wouldn't be surprised if we heard later today.
It's a little scary sitting here. Realizing you're headed for Congress, first time out, you know?
I am a first-time candidate, and I have made many scary jumps. I jumped into medical school. I jumped into residency. I jumped into a candidacy, which is no small feat. And now I am jumping into, hopefully, being a congresswoman and going to bat for the people in this district. And I am excited to take on the challenge and excited to bring my particular expertise to Congress. There are no other women doctors in Congress. So let's go.
Kim Schreier, the apparent winner in the 8th Congressional District. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.